praying it wouldn't go to Obama's head. His ego was robust enough already. They even conferred on the senator a new nickname, Black Jesus. Obama may have been a buck-raking messiah, but he was all too aware that he was still just a freshman and therefore at the beck and call of his party's leadership. So when he was summoned one day in July to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's office without the slightest explanation why, he promptly hoofed it over there, remarking to Gibbs on his way out the door, "I wonder what we screwed up." Obama's relationship with the leader was cordial enough, but it was hardly warm or close. Now he found himself sitting in the chair across from Reid in his quarters in the Capitol. From the wall above Reid's desk, the impassive visage of Samuel Clemens, rendered in a giant oil painting, mutely observed the proceedings. At 66, Reid was a little more than 20 years older than Obama, but in terms of style and demeanor, the generation gap between them seemed much wider. Awkward and halting, vaguely archaic, Reid didn't like wasting words or time. On his mind today was Obama's future in the Senate, and he got right to the point. "You're not going to go anyplace here," Reid declared soon after Obama took his seat. "I know that you don't like it, doing what you're doing." In observing Obama for the past year and a half, Reid had sensed his frustration and impatience, had heard rumblings that Obama was already angling to head back home and take a shot at the Illinois governorship. Reid had no idea if it was true, but he knew this much. Obama simply wasn't cut out to be a Senate lifer. As Obama listened to the senior senator from Nevada, he wasn't sure where the old man was going. But then Reid's disquisition took an unexpected turn, surprising Obama in both its bluntness and adamancy. 20 minutes later, the meeting was over, and Obama headed back to his Warren in the Hart Building. He breezed through the lobby, down the hall, and into Gibbs's office, closing the door behind him. "So?" asked Gibbs from behind his desk. "What did we fuck up?" "Nothing," Obama replied. "Harry wants me to run for president." "That whole meeting was about you running for president?"
"Yeah," Obama said, then grinned. "He really wants me to run for president."
Harry Reid wasn't alone among Senate Democrats in the dawning desire to see Obama chuck his hat into the ring. Although Clinton hadn't yet formally declared her intention to enter the race, in political circles it was seen as a foregone conclusion, as was her status as the heir apparent, the prohibitive frontrunner-in-waiting, and that was making many Democrats distinctly nervous in the summer of 2006. The reasons for their unease were many. In her first term in the Senate, Hillary had built a record of bipartisan accomplishment and a wealth of expertise on matters of policy. She had earned a reputation in the lingo of the Senate as a workhorse and not a show horse. But polling revealed that her negative ratings were perilously high across the country, and especially outside the bluest states. She remained, as ever, a polarizing creature, one who would widen the chasmal partisan divide that opened up during her husband's two White House terms and only deepened in those of his successor. Her 2002 vote to authorize the Iraq War made her as toxic to some on the left as she was on the right. Democrats feared she might be unelectable in the best of circumstances, and not merely unelectable, but a catastrophe for the party, her presence atop the ticket hobbling House and Senate Democrats in red and purple states across the board. And then there was the other thing, which threatened to create something closer to the worst of circumstances. The other thing was Bill, more specifically, his personal life, about which rumors were running rampant. Not since the Lewinsky era had they been more pervasive, the topic of tittering in every quadrant of the Democratic establishment, from New York to Boston to Los Angeles. And nowhere was the scuttlebutt flowing more freely than in Washington. Over lunch one afternoon that summer with a Democratic senator to whom he was close, John McCain exclaimed, "What the hell is Bill Clinton doing to Hillary?" McCain was friendly with the Clintons. He meant them no injury, but for his across-the-aisle colleague, the conversation threw into sharp relief the nightmare scenario that was causing so many Democrats such angst, that Hillary would skate to the Democratic nomination and then be destroyed in the general election when Republicans peddled the details of her husband's reputed dalliances to the press. One party elder described the situation thus:
It's like some Japanese epic film where everyone sees the disaster coming in the third reel, but no one can figure out what to do about it. Reid was well aware that such thoughts were rippling through the Democratic caucus. In truth, he shared them. After the aching disappointments of 2000 and 2004, and after the depredations Democrats believed Bush had inflicted on the country, the sense of urgency about taking back the White House was bordering on manic. The obvious answer was to find a plausible challenger to Clinton, someone who wouldn't weigh down the rest of the party's candidates, even if he were defeated in the general election. The problem was that none of the Democrats contemplating a bid fit the bill. Edwards was regarded as a shallow, callow pretender by virtually every one of his former colleagues. Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, and Evan Bayh were fine senators, but all would be crushed by Clinton. Ditto Bill Richardson, Mark Warner, and Tom Vilsack. John Kerry was saddled with more baggage than a curbside porter at Dulles Airport. Only Al Gore, rejuvenated by his fiery opposition to Bush on the war and his celebrated climate change crusade, seemed to have what it took to make a credible run at Clinton. But Gore evinced almost zero interest in climbing back into the ring. The pickings, in other words, were mighty slim, except for Obama. Years later, Reid would claim that he was steadfastly neutral in the 2008 race, that he never chose sides between Barack and Hillary, that all he did was tell Obama that he could be president, that the stars could align for him. But at the time, in truth, his encouragement of Obama was unequivocal. He was wowed by Obama's oratorical gifts and believed that the country was ready to embrace a black presidential candidate, especially one such as Obama, a light-skinned African-American with no Negro dialect, unless he wanted to have one, as he later put it privately. Reid was convinced, in fact, that Obama's race would help him more than hurt him in a bid for the Democratic nomination. He argued that Obama's lack of experience might not be crippling. It might actually be an asset, allowing him to cast himself as a figure uncorrupted and uncoopted by evil Washington, without the burdens of countless Senate votes and floor speeches. And, unlike Clinton, Obama had come out forcefully and early against Bush's Iraq incursion. In 2002, while he was still a state senator, he'd given a heralded speech in which he said, "I don't oppose all wars. What I am opposed to is a dumb war." Reid wasn't sure Obama could defeat Clinton. Probably he couldn't, but he was the only person in the party who stood a fighting chance, the best available alternative. Obama had heard these arguments before from other senators. His friend and Illinois counterpart, Dick Durbin, was urging him to run, but that was to be expected. More intriguing were the entreaties he was receiving from New York's Chuck Schumer. Schumer's relationship with Hillary had always been fraught with rivalry and tinged with jealousy. Though she was technically the junior member of the New York team in the Senate, she had eclipsed him in terms of celebrity and influence from the moment she arrived on the Hill. By 2006, they had found their way to a mostly peaceful coexistence. Yet, because of the circles in which he traveled, Schumer was more familiar than most with the tittle-tattle about her husband's alleged infidelities. He heard people debating what Hillary should do to preserve her political viability when the scandal inevitably broke. Divorce him or ride it out again. Schumer was also the chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and in that role had seen Obama's efforts up close on behalf of the party's candidates. He was blown away by Obama's fundraising prowess and the enthusiasm he generated in states traditionally inhospitable to Democrats. The political handicapper in him was fascinated by Obama's potential to redraw the electoral map, a capacity Clinton surely lacked. In conversations with other senators and strategists in 2006, Schumer would make these points over and over. He made them to Obama as well, and repeatedly. In one instance, Schumer even double-teamed him with Reid. Although Schumer was careful to signal that home state decorum would prohibit him from opposing Clinton publicly, "You understand my position," he would say. He left no doubt as to where his head and heart were on the question. These were not the only senatorial voices importuning Obama. Daschle, too, was on the case, and so was a coterie of senators close to him, including Byron Dorgan and Kent Conrad, both of North Dakota, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, Bill Nelson of Florida,
Barbara Boxer of California, and even Ted Kennedy, all were nudging Obama to take the plunge. Their conversations with Barack were surreptitious, a conspiracy of whispers. They told him that 2008 was going to be a change election and that he uniquely could embody transformation. They told him he might never get a better chance. They told him that this could be his time. But they also added the same caveats as Schumer. Keen as they were for Obama to run, they would never be able to bless him with an early endorsement. Coming out against Hillary would pose grave risks. The Clintons had long memories and a vindictive streak 10 miles wide. If Hillary prevailed, they feared, no, they were certain, there would be retribution down the line. But they would root for Obama secretly, doing whatever they could to help without affronting the aborning Democratic dynasty. It would be many months before the Clintons gained any awareness of the incipient betrayal of Hillary by her colleagues in the Senate. And then it would hit them like a ton of bricks in their psychic solar plexus. The Clintons saw themselves as the party's de facto first family, as the patrons of two generations of Democratic politicians for whom they'd raised stacks of cash, providing aid and comfort on the path to prominence, as the only Democrats in recent memory who had demonstrated a consistent capacity to win national elections, as revered and beloved figures. They were blind to the degree of Clinton fatigue in their world and deaf to the conspiracy of whispers. They had no idea how fast the ground was shifting beneath their feet. And neither, really, did Obama, until his conversation with Reid. Like everyone else in Washington, Obama took as a given the fearsome potency of the Clinton machine. Despite all the exhortations to take on Hillary, there were many reasons to believe that such an enterprise would be pure folly, that she was unstoppable, a juggernaut. But Obama had to wonder, Schumer, Dorgan, Durbin, and now Reid, these four men comprised the upper echelon of the official Democratic leadership in the Senate. Maybe the establishment wasn't as foursquare behind the Clintons as conventional wisdom held. Maybe there was an opening. A few days after his meeting with Reid, Obama was telling Jared about what had happened in the leader's office. She listened to Obama's description of the Reid meeting and was impressed, but Jared wanted to know what it meant in concrete terms. "Is he going to endorse you and support you?" she asked. "No," Obama answered. "So what good is it for him to tell you that you should run if he's not going to help you?" "He just thinks I should do it, but he doesn't want to cross Senator Clinton," Obama replied. "He thinks I can win." Besides Michelle, Jarrett knew Barack Obama as well as anyone. She had watched him begin to wrestle with the idea of running for president for months. For the first time, she could see him thinking, "Maybe I can do this." Chapter 3. The Ground Beneath Her Feet. Bill Clinton knew his wife could do it, and do it damn well, too. From the time they fell in love 3 decades earlier at Yale Law School, he had been in awe of Hillary. She was the smartest, most committed, most idealistic, most impressive person he had ever met. He thought she hung the moon. Some felt that she had the nomination locked up, but would face a daunting challenge in the general election. Bill Clinton believed the opposite, a point he made repeatedly to anyone who would listen. "This primary is going to be harder than the general," he would say. "I'm just telling all you people this." Clinton's assessment was based primarily on one thing: the anger of the party's liberal base at Hillary's vote to authorize the Iraq War and her continued refusal to recant it. By the late fall of 2005, the former president was convinced that his wife needed to find her way to a more politically palatable position. With elections in Iraq scheduled for that December, the body count rising and sectarian violence raging in the region, calls were intensifying for a droop reduction or even a full-scale withdrawal. On November 13th, Edwards, whom the Clintons considered Hillary's most serious rival for the nomination, published an op-ed in the Washington Post apologizing for his own Senate vote in favor of authorizing the war. Its first sentence, "I was wrong." The pressure was mounting on Hillary to do the same. Mark Penn, Bill knew, argued vehemently that mea culpa would cause Hillary more harm than good. Penn believed her vote was right on the merits and that defending it was smart politics. He contended that the biggest hurdle Hillary would have to surmount if she ran for president was the doubt that a woman was capable of being commander-in-chief. At all times, she had to project strength, resolution, rough and readiness, and do absolutely nothing that signaled squishiness. He told the Clintons that his polling showed that sticking to her guns on Iraq played to her advantage as a character issue. Apologizing now would only invite Republicans to characterize her later as another cut-and-run Democrat in the mold of Kerry, Dukakis, and McGovern. Bill had enormous faith in Penn and his numbers. The bond between them was forged in 1996, when Clinton's ideologically androgynous Svengali, Dick Morris, brought the pollster into that year's re-election effort and then was caught up in a toe-sucking scandal with a prostitute, leaving Penn with the presidential ear, and cemented by Penn's skillful navigation of the survival politics of impeachment and his central role in Hillary's Senate victory. But even if an apology was off the table, surely there was a middle ground to be claimed, Clinton thought. In 1991, he had faced a comparable situation when he was asked if he would have voted to authorize the elder Bush's Gulf War. His answer was vintage Clinton. I guess I would have voted for the majority if it was a close vote, but I agree with the arguments the minority made. The trouble was that Hillary, for all her virtues, lacked the suppleness or slipperiness that was one of her husband's fortes. He knew better than anyone that she was less capable of the artful shuck and jive that he could muster on his clumsiest day, so he resolved to assist her in making a pivot to a safer berth. The first step came on November 16th, just 3 days after Edwards' op-ed, when Bill, in Dubai, on a swing through the Middle East on behalf of his philanthropic Clinton Global Fund, deviated from his prior support for the war by declaring in a speech that the invasion of Iraq was a big mistake, adding that Saddam is gone, it's a good thing, but I don't agree with what was done. A few days later, Bill landed in Jerusalem and set to work ghostwriting a letter for his wife to email to her constituents reframing her stance on the war. In his suite at the King David Hotel, Clinton labored long into the night, editing and re-editing faxed copies of the text in his illegible longhand scrawl. Well after midnight, he summoned Jay Carson, his 28-year-old communications director, to his room and showed him the letter. The gist of what Hillary would assert: if Congress in 2002 possessed the information that it had at its disposal today, Bush never would have asked it to authorize the use of force in Iraq, and if he had, he would have been refused. What do you think? Clinton asked. I think this is good. I think this gets her in the right place. Carson was aware that Hillary and her aides had been furiously debating how to handle her war vote for months, but to see his boss behaving this obsessively reinforced his sense of the gravity of the problem. Man, this is serious, he thought. Carson went back to his room to get some sleep, but a couple of hours later, he was called again to Clinton's suite to repeat the routine. It was nearly 3 o'clock in the morning now, but Clinton was still twitchy, uncertain. Did the letter go far enough? Did it find the sweet spot? Would it defang the anti-warriors? I don't know. I just don't know, Clinton said, shaking his head. She can't listen to me or anyone else because she can't go out there and defend it every day if she doesn't agree with what she's saying. She's got to do what she thinks is right and then just try to weather the storm. Hillary Clinton had encountered few storms, and certainly none of this magnitude or potential consequence, in her first 5 years in the Senate. In many ways, her entire time in office had been orchestrated to avoid them. Punctiliously, painstakingly, she had set about remediating her political liabilities, putting herself in the best possible position to lead her party. She had moderated her ideological profile, burnished her credentials, honed her policy chops, established herself as a diligent legislator, demonstrated her dedication to her constituents in New York, sanded down every jagged edge from her formerly serrated public image. She had endeavored mightily, in other words, to place herself firmly in the Democratic mainstream, to make herself a figure of respect and admiration, of party cohesion and not divisiveness, and not least, to create for herself a separate and distinct political persona and operation from that of her husband. By 2006, Clinton had achieved all that with a strategy subtler and savvier than most understood. Her public posture in the Senate, it was widely noted, revolved around bipartisanship and deference, despite her built-in superstardom. Her outreach to Republicans was so ostentatious that it bordered on the masochistic, co-sponsoring legislation with 49 of them, taking pains to mend fences with those who had voted to impeach her husband, joining a Senate prayer group favored by the GOP's staunchest social conservatives. In private, however, Clinton's approach was nearly the polar opposite, partisan and assertive to its core. She believed passionately in a more activist government, in a progressive agenda, and she was tired of seeing Democrats flounder in their aims simply because they lacked a coherent message, organizational skills, and a crisp, high-sticking strategy. Convinced that liberals needed an infrastructure to match the network of think tanks and advocacy groups that had bolstered the right for decades, she assisted John Podesta, one of her husband's former chiefs of staff, in launching the Center for American Progress and advised the liberal watchdog group Media Matters for America. Her goal was to better fortify her party against the dense, cold-blooded armament of the Bush White House, to lay a protective groundwork for Democratic interests on the Hill. But she also was thinking ahead, to another Clinton presidential campaign and administration, when those reinforcements could ease her path and abet her power. Within the Senate, she was something of a scold toward her party's leadership, forever prodding Reid to develop a sharper and more consistent approach to battling the Republicans. Her opinion of his predecessor, Daschle, was no better. She had quickly pegged him as an ineffectual and weak, a Bush leaguer in a big league job, and his loss at the polls in 2004 had only confirmed her early verdict. Clinton's prescription for both her and the party's reformation was rooted in the lessons she drew from recent history, from the failures of 2004, 2000, and especially the 90s. Although her husband had dragged Democrats kicking and screaming into the modern age substantively and ideologically, she considered his administration a tactical and operational disaster, soft, undisciplined, woolly-minded, and leaky. The political machine that Hillary built for herself was its opposite in every regard. The people comprising it, on her Senate staff, at her PAC, and among her outside advisors, were loyal to a fault, smart and ruthless, hard-headed and hard-boiled. With few exceptions, they embraced her conception of politics as total war and shared her reflexive antipathy to the Fourth Estate. They more closely resembled Bush's operation than Bill Clinton's, and were happy, even proud, to admit it. They referred to themselves collectively as Hillary Land, and everyone else in politics did too. More than any other player, Solis Doyle embodied the culture of Hillary Land. The sixth child of Mexican parents who came to America and settled in Chicago, she started out as Hillary's scheduler in 1991 and steadily amassed duties and influence from there on. She had a ready laugh and a teasing wit, but could be brutal in her role as the chief enforcer of Hillary Land's Code of Omerta and rarely spoke to reporters. More than her political acumen, it was her almost daughterly connection to Hillary that was her source of power. At 41, she was the first and last aide Clinton consulted on any big decision and was often said to possess the capacity to channel her boss's thinking. And yet, in terms of Hillary Land mojo, Solis Doyle was matched by Penn, who exerted an iron grip on Clinton's message strategy. Appointed CEO of the public relations behemoth Burson Marsteller in 2005, he spent the previous three decades polling on behalf of clients ranging from Ed Koch to Tony Blair, along with companies such as Microsoft and Avis, and had made a specialty of carving up the electorate into itty-bitty demographic and psychographic slices and propounding micro-policies to satisfy voters' cravings and allay their anxieties. He was 52 years old, doughy, disheveled, and socially maladroit. In the Clinton White House, his nickname had alternated between Schlumpy and Schlumbo. Hillary was attached to Solis Doyle and Penn for different reasons, and they in turn reflected different aspects of her character. What she liked about Solis Doyle was her crawl-across-broken-glass fealty, her discretion, and the mind meld the two of them had achieved. Patty was a comfortable and comforting presence. What she liked about Penn was his data-drivenness, his tendency to frame even the grubbiest issues and nastiest tactics in lofty policy terms, and most of all, his certitude. When her own political instincts were muddy, as they often were, he told her what to do. The job that the Hillary Landers had done for Hillary had been masterly by any measure. They helped her win her Senate seat when people said it was a pipe dream. They helped her lay waste to the prevailing caricature of her, an arrogant, corrupt, power-mad, harsh, hypocritical liberal, and sketched a new picture, a competent, clever, hard-working, determined, pragmatic centrist that boosted her popularity ratings to the moon. They were on the way to helping her collect nearly $50 million for her Senate re-election campaign that year, in which she faced only token opposition. And whatever money was left over could be put directly into a presidential bid, assuming she decided to take the plunge into that pool. But now, the controversy over Hillary's war vote threatened to eclipse everything she had accomplished. The King David letter, despite Bill's best efforts, did nothing to subdue her critics. If anything, the attacks only grew more vitriolic in the first half of 2006, as Clinton refused to endorse the demand of some liberal Democrats for a firm timetable for troop withdrawal. To Hillary Land, the assault on her from the left was a test, and the results were not encouraging. The internal deliberations over how to handle the situation consumed dozens upon dozens of meetings and conference calls. Her people debated the matter endlessly, but never reached a conclusion. What should she do? Introduce legislation? Give a speech? Sit for an interview? And if so, what should she say? Stand her ground? Apologize? What? Hillary had no intention of saying she was sorry. I don't have anything to apologize for, she thought. You want me to apologize for the fact that the president is an idiot? Hillary liked to say that she was blessed, or cursed, with a responsibility gene. It was no small part of why, as a senator from New York in the wake of 9/11, she had voted to authorize the war in the first place, and why she was resistant to pushing for a date certain for withdrawal now. If she did run for president and wound up in the Oval Office, the decisions regarding Iraq would fall into her lap, and having lived in the White House, she understood the presidential premium on flexibility. Then there were the politics of the matter. I'm not going to let myself be dragged too far left during the primary season, she explained to one of her most generous donors. If she reversed herself now, she would be buying a one-way ticket to Kerryville. The GOP would tattoo her forehead with the lethal flip-flopper label. And so would the press. Of that, she was certain. The standards to which she was held by the media, she believed, and not without reason, were so much more strict and latently hostile than those applied to any other politician in the country. Everything I do carries political risk because nobody gets the scrutiny that I get, she told a reporter. It's not like I have any margin for error whatsoever. I don't. Everybody else does, and I don't. And that's fine. That's just who I am, and that's what I live with. The Iraq dilemma was vexing, a pure Hobson's choice. She was damned if she did and damned if she didn't. And so she adopted her husband's method and split the difference. In the King David letter, Hillary had claimed that she wasn't voting for war in 2002, but instead for more diplomacy. Now she decided to add her name to legislation that urged the president to begin a phased redeployment of the troops by the end of 2006. How the Democratic base would react to these maneuvers was an open question. In mid-June, brave in a hot pink pantsuit before a rancorous crowd of several thousand progressive activists at the Take Back America conference at the Washington Hilton, Clinton excoriated the Bush administration's domestic agenda and its handling of Iraq for having rushed to war, refused to let the UN inspectors conduct and complete their mission, committed strategic blunder after blunder, and undermined America's leadership in the world. But then Clinton raised her hands defensively and added, with a mild quaver in her voice, I just have to say it, I do not think it is a smart strategy either for the president to continue with his open-ended commitment, which I think does not put enough pressure on the new Iraqi government, nor do I think it is smart strategy to set a date certain. I do not agree that that is in the best interest of our troops or our country. The crowd erupted. Why not? People yelled amid a cacophony of boos and hisses so raucous that Clinton could barely be heard above the din. Stepping down off the stage, she was serenaded with chants of protest. Bring the troops home! Bring the troops home! As she made her way to the exit. The anti-war base was sending a fundamental message. Clinton's front-runner status was rooted in shaky ground. As wary as she was of being stereotyped as a conventional liberal, a la Kerry or Dean, Hillary didn't fully apprehend that her split-the-difference stance was reviving an equally damaging narrative. With it, and with a handful of other moves that smacked of cynicism, her co-sponsorship of a bill to criminalize flag burning was frequently cited. Clinton was breathing new life into perceptions that she had done so much to slay, that she was a calculating, expedient schemer, wedded to no great principle other than her own advancement. For many Democrats, trimming, triangulating, and poll-tested centrism were among the least appetizing features of the Clinton years. But, of course, there were others, as Hillary herself was reminded all the time, in the most unpleasant ways. When she first got the word, she was stunned and angry. The New York Times was doing what? There was just no way it could be true. But it was, she was told by her press secretary, Philippe Raines, and his counterpart for her husband, Jay Carson. In the spring of 2006, the paper of record was in the midst of reporting a story on the state of the Clinton marriage. And from what the Flex could ascertain from their conversations with the reporter, it wasn't going to be pretty. The thrust of the piece, they believed, was that the marriage was a sham, that Hillary and Bill barely saw each other, rarely slept in the same bed, that their matrimony was a partnership, an understanding, but little more, that Bill's bachelor lifestyle had the potential to derail her presidential aspirations. How is this a legitimate story, Hillary wanted to know. And not just a story, but a story in the most esteemed newspaper in the country. It's just fucking unbelievable, she said. This is my life. I have to deal with this bullshit. Carson and Raines suspected that the Times' true intention was more pernicious still. The paper wanted to write about the rumors swirling around Bill Clinton's alleged infidelities and was using a discussion of the Clinton marriage as a camouflage. Within Hillary's and Bill's operations, a series of heated discussions ensued about whether to engage with the reporter, Patrick Healy, or simply say no comment. The dominant view inside Hillary land, with its aversion to the press, was that to participate would do nothing but legitimize the story. Carson and Raines strongly disagreed. Guys, the story is likely to be on page A1 of the New York Times, Carson said. It's already legitimized. Carson and Raines considered Healy an ethical reporter, persuadable by the facts. Weighing in, they felt could influence the piece, soften it, and at least prevent errors or egregious insinuations from appearing in print. Carson and Raines prevailed in that debate and spent a frantic weekend pushing back on the story. They pulled schedules to demonstrate that the Clintons spent plenty of nights together, more, in fact, than Chuck Schumer spent with his wife, Iris. The Clintons loved each other, the press guys insisted. This was not a marriage in name only. When the story appeared on May 23rd, the Clinton camps were braced for the worst. But although it was indeed on A1, the effects of Carson's and Raines' efforts were evident. The piece was elliptical, full of loaded language and ominous hints, but contained no damaging facts. Even better, from the Clinton perspective, the reaction from readers was harsh, a flood of letters denouncing the paper for going tabloid, for slumming in the gutter. Stung by the criticisms, the Times' public editor felt compelled to devote a column to justifying the article. Months later, Carson would tell Bill Clinton that the story, for all the agita around it, turned out to be a blessing in disguise. For as long as anyone could remember, Carson thought, reporters had been dying to peek inside the couple's bedroom. The Clinton people warned them not to do it. There's a big, mean dog in there, they suggested, ready to chew your face off. Now the Times had ventured in and come out bleeding. From that point on, for 2 solid years, not a single reporter approached Clinton World in pursuit of a similar story. Yet the Clinton victory in the moment was a Pyrrhic one. In Washington, the fact that the Times, the prudish, starchy, self-important gray lady, had been willing to go there, however awkwardly, merely turned up the flame on the burning speculation about Bill's putative priapism. What had been a slow simmer in 2005 became a roiling boil in the summer and fall of 2006, as the chattering classes theorized about whether and why the Times had pulled its punches. Worse, Clinton World was hearing that a gusher of gossip was flowing from members of the couple's own inner circle, and in particular from Steve Ricchetti, the longtime consigliere to Bill, who had been so keen on Hillary running for president in 2004. Since his departure from the White House, Bill Clinton had not exactly erred on the side of caution when it came to his personal comportment. Within days of settling into the Clintons' new house in Chappaqua in 2001, he could be found at Lang's Deli, chatting up the stay-at-home mothers who trundled in after yoga, startling his aides that he already knew all the women by name.
He gallivanted around the world with his business partner Ron Burkle, the supermarket magnate and notorious playboy, whose custom-converted Boeing 757 was referred to by Burkle's young aides as Air Fuck One. Clinton's regular trips to that carnal triptych of Los Angeles, Miami, and Las Vegas struck many of his friends as a recipe, if not for trouble, then at least for undue temptation and embarrassment. But Bill seemed not to care. He was going to do what he wanted to do, appearances be damned. And yet, Bill was ripshit when Carson and Terry McAuliffe informed him of the extent to which tongues were wagging in Washington. "Those goddamn people in D.C.," Clinton fumed. "They don't have anything better to do than talk about my sex life. Goddamn that city. This is why I hated it from the beginning down there. Everybody's got boring lives, so they just sit around and talk about someone else's." All the murmurings about Bill were starting to get back to Hillary land as well. When Silas Doyle made the rounds of senior party players, members of Congress, major donors, former cabinet secretaries, to chat about Hillary's prospective presidential run, she was encountering a troubling pattern. Almost uniformly, the Democratic grandees professed their affection and respect for Senator Clinton. "She's terrific," they said. "She'd be a good candidate and make a great president." But then would come the inevitable addendum. "What are you going to do about Bill?" What Silas Doyle invariably would say was, "We've got that under control." It was a clever answer she had come up with herself, and it seemed to pacify her listeners. But Patty was rattled by the specificity of the chatter she was hearing. One rumor was that Bill Clinton was having an affair with a dishy Canadian member of Parliament, Belinda Stronach. Another involved a wealthy divorcee, Julie Tauber McMahon, who lived in Chappaqua. Another revolved around the Hollywood actress Gina Gershon, and the list went on. Silas Doyle was equally unnerved by the caliber of the people indulging in the speculation. One day, she paid a visit to Ricchetti, who mentioned without blinking that he'd recently been on a conference call with a handful of big-name Clinton stalwarts, including former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin, which devolved into a prolonged discussion of Bill's supposed indiscretions and the danger they posed to Hillary. This is a problem, Silas Doyle thought, and not a small one. These were heavy-hitting Clinton supporters who had Hillary's best interests at heart, whose intent was anything but malicious, who were actually trying to help. Silas Doyle decided that she needed to tell Hillary, and quick. She had brought word to Hillary more than once about the rumors hovering around Bill. "It's not true," Hillary would say, and in any case, she knew how to handle it. She had some experience in this area, after all, and she had always emerged intact. "We'll be ready for it," she said, and then, again, "it's not true." But Silas Doyle needed Hillary to listen this time, to appreciate the implications of what was happening. "You don't understand," she said insistently. "They're having conference calls about this. What he's doing, who he's doing it with, how it's going to damage you." The mention of conference calls snapped Hillary to attention. She demanded to know who was on the calls. Silas Doyle told her. Hillary reeled, first stunned into silence by the betrayal, then loudly livid about their friends trafficking this crap behind her back. "How dare they? They don't know anything. Who do they think they are?" Hillary had always been adamant that her and her husband's personal lives were nobody's business but theirs. She immediately froze Ricchetti out of Hillary land. The reaction in Bill Clinton's world was even harsher. When other staffers asked Doug Band, the former president's chief counselor, why Ricchetti was no longer included on regular conference calls of old White House hands, Band icily replied, "He's dead to us." Hillary wasn't in complete denial about the perils of the situation, however. She had seen the damage that Bill's bimbo eruptions could inflict and knew that his imputed peccadilloes were among the gravest potential impediments to her reaching the White House. Clinton turned to two aides she trusted with the most intimate matters, Silas Doyle and Cheryl Mills, and Silas Doyle included Howard Wolfson in the circle. Together, the trio formed a war room within a war room inside Hillary land, dedicated to managing the threat posed by Bill's libido. Mills, the lawyer, handled delicate matters where attorney-client privilege might prove useful. Silas Doyle was in charge of the political dimension, and Wolfson worked the media side of the equation. The war room within a war room dismissed or discredited much of the gossip floating around, but not all of it. The stories about one woman were more concrete, and after some discreet fact-finding,
the group concluded that they were true, that Bill was indeed having an affair, and not a frivolous one-night stand, but a sustained romantic relationship. This was exactly the scenario that had incited so many members of the conspiracy of whispers to urge Obama into the race, and what everyone who signed up with Hillary feared each waking day. But whatever storm of emotions Clinton herself might have been experiencing, she put aside in the interest of survival. She instructed her team to prepare to deal with the potential blow-up of Bill's personal life. For months thereafter, the war room within a war room braced for the explosion, which her aides knew could come at any time. Yet, even without any detonations, the Bill-related rumblings and their reverberations would continue and be absorbed by Hillary in painful, maddening, and portentous ways. In October, she was scheduled to headline a New York fundraiser for Claire McCaskill, the Democratic candidate for Senate in Missouri. McCaskill, a plain-spoken centrist who held the job of state auditor, had narrowly lost a run for governor in 2004. She'd been expected to take another shot at that office 4 years later, but had decided against it out of fear that Clinton would be her party's presidential nominee in 2008. According to a story in The New Yorker in May 2006, McCaskill had told people in Missouri and in Washington that a ticket led by Clinton would be fatal for many Democrats on the ballot, and that a Clinton candidacy would rule out her chance to win the governorship. Hillary Land was not amused by the New Yorker piece, but McCaskill smoothed things over with the Clintons, apologizing, claiming she'd been quoted out of context. In September, Bill flew to St. Louis and did a fundraiser for McCaskill, and now Hillary was set to help fill her coffers, though not coincidentally, 900 miles away from the Missouri media. The day before the New York fundraiser, however, McCaskill appeared on Meet the Press and was asked by Russert if she thought that Bill Clinton had been a great president. "I do," McCaskill said. "I have a lot of problems with some of his personal issues." Russert began to speak, but McCaskill cut him off. "I said at the time, I think he's been a great leader, but I don't want my daughter near him." Raines was in Chicago to attend a wedding and happened to be watching the show. Mortified, he knew that someone had to inform Hillary before the fundraiser took place. He emailed the quote around Hillary Land. Everyone was aghast, and no one wanted to tell the senators, so Raines was saddled with the unpleasant duty. "So what's going on?" Hillary asked when Raines reached her by phone. "Oh, not much," Raines replied, running through the day's news, the guests on the Sunday shows, and then, at the end, sidling up gingerly to McCaskill's comment. "She said what?" Hillary asked incredulously. Raines read her the quote verbatim. "I think he's been a great leader, but I don't want my daughter near him." The phone went quiet. Hillary was speechless. A few more seconds passed, and then finally came her voice, hot with fury. "Fuck her," Hillary said, and then called Silas Doyle and summarily canceled the fundraiser. McCaskill would again apologize to Hillary and Bill, writing them letters begging their forgiveness and forbearance. What she said had been stupid, hurtful, insensitive, but the truth was that McCaskill meant it, just as she'd meant her earlier prediction of the damage to Democrats across the country if Hillary won the nomination. McCaskill was in the market for a different horse, and now she thought she saw one in Obama. Inside Hillary Land, the notion that Obama might enter the race seemed remote to almost everyone. Harold Ickes, a fabled Democratic operative and longtime advisor to the Clintons, was so dismissive of the idea that he offered to bet Silas Doyle $50,000 that it would never happen. Penn, too, was sure Obama would stay out. That was the skinny he was hearing from inside the Illinois senator's orbit. Hillary, for her part, had no idea what Obama would do, though she knew that he wouldn't be swayed by the argument that his experience was insufficient. "No one ever thinks they don't have the experience to do this," she told one of her aides. "No one thinks that way. He wouldn't have gotten to this point and then said, 'Oh, I don't have the experience.' You don't think about your weaknesses. You think about your strengths." But Obama's strengths didn't strike her as especially intimidating, and whether he took his weaknesses seriously or not, they were many and glaring. Sure, he had a great deal of potential, but it was just that, potential. He had no fundraising network, no tangible accomplishments in the Senate. The speeches he gave, oh, they were pretty, but so what? You don't change people's lives with words, Hillary thought. You change them with committed effort, by pushing through the opposition. You change them with a fight. That was how you won elections, too, with a fight. In his entire career, Obama had yet to be hit with a single negative ad. How would he ever withstand the sheer, unrelenting hell of a presidential race? The constant pummeling by his opponents, the withering scrutiny and X-ray intrusions of the media. But even as most of Clinton world dismissed Obama, one dissenter stewed. All that talent, the anti-war credentials, the desire for something different in the country, the combination could be deadly, Bill Clinton kept saying. This guy could be trouble. Chapter 4. Getting to Yes. Obama flew out of Washington on August 18, 2006, and arrived the next morning in Cape Town, South Africa, to start his two-week tour of the continent and the two-and-a-half-month rocket ride that would carry him to the day of the midterm elections. Rocket ride was Gibbs's term, and he wasn't exaggerating. The period would include the publication of Obama's second book, The Audacity of Hope, the national book tour to publicize it, and a marathon stretch of campaigning for Democratic candidates from coast to coast. Everyone around Obama understood that the interval would be pivotal to his decision about running for president, which he had consciously put off until November. But most of them assumed that, in the end, however tempting he found the idea, practicality would prevail. The Africa trip turned out to be a revelation for both Barack and Michelle. The last time he had been there was 14 years earlier, with a pack on his back and not much more than a packet of cigarettes in his pocket. Now, from Chad to Ethiopia to Djibouti, and especially in his father's Kenyan homeland, he was treated like a head of state, or Muhammad Ali in Zaire for the rumble in the jungle. In Nairobi, thousands lined the streets and stood on rooftops chanting, "Obama Biro, Yoni Yo! Obama's coming, clear the way." The crowds were bigger than any he had experienced since the Democratic Convention, but unlike that audience, the African throngs were there for him and him alone. Michelle found the spectacle discomforting. "Part of you just wants to say, 'Can we tame this down a little bit?'" she said at the time. "Does it have to be all this? This is out of hand." But what Michelle saw as overwhelming, her husband viewed as possibility. He began to entertain the notion that he'd tapped into something remarkable, that by virtue of what he represented, he might be able to effect change on a global scale. It was heady and humbling at the same time, nothing short of an epiphany. When Obama got home, he had one event on his calendar before the madness of the book tour began, the 29th annual Harkin Steak Fry, and in its way, it was an even bigger deal than the Africa trip. Taking place every September in Indianola, Iowa, the Steak Fry was a political fair sponsored by Senator Tom Harkin and attended by hundreds of the state's hardcore Democratic activists, and was thus a coveted speaking venue for any aspiring presidential candidate. Eager to avoid an awkward choice between Clinton, Edwards, Warner, or Vilsack, Harkin offered Obama the keynote slot on the assumption that he wasn't running. Obama's advisors were fully aware that if he accepted, the political world would erupt with speculation about his intentions. "You have to understand what this is going to indicate to a lot of people," Gibbs told Obama in a meeting with the senior staff. "They're going to think you're running." "I understand," Obama said. The truth was, he was ready to stir the pot. Going to the Steak Fry didn't commit him to anything. The media might whip itself up, but attending the event would let him take the temperature of Iowa activists, another important data point for decision time after the midterms. Obama was intent on not being sloppy about it, not showing too much or too little leg. "If we're going to do this, we have to do it right," he said, then glanced around the room. In case he wasn't being sufficiently clear, he added, "Don't fuck this up." Obama, though, was the one to blunder. After the press reported that he'd agreed to keynote the Steak Fry, Michelle's phone started ringing off the hook, with people calling about her husband's first foray into Iowa. But Michelle was totally in the dark and now steamed at him. Obama walked into his Senate office looking sheepish. "Next time I decide to make a big announcement," he said to Gibbs, "would you remind me to tell Michelle?" Not screwing up the Steak Fry itself would require staffing Obama well, and Pete Rouse had an idea, one that made sense on the merits and was sure to draw attention. They would add Steve Hildebrand to Obama's traveling party. Among Democratic insiders and political reporters, Hildebrand was renowned. a grassroots organizing savant with close ties to three foundational Democratic factions, women's groups, gay activists, and labor. Hildebrand was yet another former Daschle staffer, which was how he and Rouse were friends. But his claim to fame was having helped deliver the Iowa caucuses for Al Gore in 2000. Goateed, tattooed, and openly gay, Hildebrand was the rare top-shelf national operative who lived outside the Beltway, and way outside in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Even rarer, he was passionate about issues and had a romantic streak about politics as wide and verdant as a Paris boulevard. Hildebrand had not even seen Obama's convention keynote. A few months before the steak fry, in fact, he had met with Hillary and offered to work for her, but she brushed him off. Hildebrand returned to South Dakota and grew angry at what he saw as Clinton's weaseling over the Iraq War. So when Rouse asked him to accompany Obama to Harkin's event, Hildebrand was game. He knew that his presence in Iowa at Obama's side would set off alarm bells in the political sphere, that he was being used as a tool. The Obama people are fucking with the Clintons, he thought, and that was just fine with him. The scene that greeted Obama in Indianola was pure pandemonium. Nearly 4,000 people showed up that day at Balloon Field. At a typical steak fry, the number was 1,500. The crowd had its share of college kids from Drake and Iowa State and was so thick on the ground and eager to get close to Obama that he could barely move. His speech never quite gelled, but the crowd didn't seem to notice. Afterward, as Obama made his way down an endless rope line with cameras capturing his every move, fans thrust copies of Dreams from My Father at him to autograph. "Thank you for giving us hope," one person told Obama. Hildebrand was thunderstruck. It reminded him of the images of the Clinton-Gore bus tour after the convention in 1992, the rabid, spontaneous enthusiasm, the palpable sense of connection, the future is nowness of it. As they walked to the parking lot afterward, he asked Obama, "How do these people know so much about you?" "I don't know, the convention speech, and then it just grew from there."
"Is it like this in other places?" Obama shrugged and said, "It's like this everywhere we go."
The following morning, Hildebrand received an email from Silas Doyle. "Saw your name in the New York Times. Hope you don't make any decisions before we have a chance to talk." Hildebrand laughed. "Hillary Clinton? Please." His decision was already made. He would do whatever it took to get Obama in the race, then elect him president. The Obama book tour was purposefully structured to approximate the rigors of a presidential campaign. Gibbs wanted to give his boss a taste of what nonstop life on the road would be like. Each day of the tour would be in a different city and have three elements, a book signing, a political event, and a thank you get-together for his donors. Because Obama had missed his deadline repeatedly, the publication date of The Audacity of Hope had been pushed back to October 17th, shortening the tour to just a week, and also putting the book in direct competition with John Grisham's first nonfiction opus, The Innocent Man, which hit the shelves the same day. The Grisham title entered the bestseller lists at number one, with Obama's at number two. When Obama learned of the rankings, he was peevish, a little whiny. "But I want to be number one," he complained. In Chicago, Jarrett threw Obama a book party at the home of her parents. It was pouring rain, and despite a tent in the backyard and umbrella-toting underlings, many of the attendees got soaked, their shoes ruined by the mud. Jarrett introduced Obama and spoke about Audacity's final chapter, in which he wrote about the stress that the demands of his career put on his marriage, the disruptions to his family life. As Jarrett went on, talking about the sacrifices his wife and girls were making, she saw that Obama was crying, to the point where he couldn't manage to speak when it came his turn. Michelle walked over, put her arm around him, and began to cry as well. Even Obama's closest friends had never seen him choke up in public before. "He's not emoting about the past," Jarrett thought. "He's emoting about the future, about the fact that the sacrifices he's imposed on his family are only just beginning." On October 22nd, Obama returned to Tim Russert's set for another appearance on Meet the Press. The day before, he'd ridden down from Philadelphia in a limousine with Axelrod and Gibbs. Axelrod warned Obama that Russert would surely revisit his unequivocal reaffirmation from earlier that year that he would absolutely not be on the national ticket in 2008. It took no great genius to see the question coming. Obama's face was on the cover of that week's Time, beside a headline that read, "Why Barack Obama Could Be the Next President." Axelrod, impersonating Russert, intoned, "And so, Senator, here's the tape. Is that still your position?" Here was the question that had tied Hillary Clinton in knots in 2003, that 12 years earlier had caused her husband to stage a contrived tour around Arkansas to solicit a release from his pledge not to run for president. But Obama hardly gave the conundrum a moment's thought. He couldn't see any point in shilly-shallying over what was patently true. "I'm going to tell him no," he said to Axelrod and Gibbs. "I think it's best to say I'm reconsidering." A few minutes later, Obama was on the phone with Michelle. Following previous orders, Gibbs whispered urgently, "Tell her about tomorrow." But Obama already had. Michelle wasn't pleased with what her husband planned to say. She had serious doubts about the notion of a presidential bid, but she was under no illusions about what was going on inside her husband's head. Obama's new answer on Meet the Press, "Russert, it's fair to say you're thinking about running?" "Obama, it's fair, yes," set off a firestorm in the press, all right. A firestorm of febrile excitement over the possibility that he was running, and of analysis about what it might mean and how it might play out. Few in the media seemed to notice or care that Obama had broken his pledge, preferring instead to praise his candor. With Obama now leaving the door ajar, even if only a bit, as he said on the air, an even greater friction suffused his homestretch campaigning in the 2 weeks before the midterms. He was often doing four events a day, hopscotching from state to state to raise last-minute cash for incumbents and challengers alike. The punishing schedule made Obama grouchy. "Why the fuck am I going to Indiana?" he squawked to Hope Fund's political director, Elisa Mastromonaco. "There are three candidates, and they're running out of money. If we can go and raise $200,000 at this fundraiser, we'll keep them on the air through Election Day," she retorted. "Really?" Obama asked skeptically, but then agreed to go. All three candidates won. On the Sunday before the midterms, Obama attended church in Tennessee with Democratic Congressman Harold Ford Jr., the African-American Senate candidate there, whose campaign had been rocked by a negative TV ad that fanned fears of miscegenation, a reminder to Obama that race was still a combustible electoral factor. He did stops in Illinois, Ohio, and Iowa, where Hildebrand could be found handing out hundreds of unauthorized Obama for President buttons that he'd had made up, and traveled to St. Louis to campaign for Claire McCaskill. At that last stop, thousands of people lined up for hours outside the World's Fair Pavilion to hear Obama speak. Among those on stage was former Missouri Senator Tom Eagleton, who had briefly been George McGovern's running mate in 1972 and was among the party's most beloved figures. Dressed in yellow pants and a green crewneck sweater, Eagleton was nearly 80 years old and in poor health. This would be his last major public appearance before his death. But Eagleton desperately wanted a gander at Obama. When the event was over, he approached McCaskill and marveled, "I haven't seen people want to touch someone that way since Bobby Kennedy." On November 8th, the day after the Democrats routed the congressional GOP, retaking control of Congress and repudiating George W. Bush, Obama drove to the brick building in the River North neighborhood of Chicago that housed the offices of Axelrod's consulting firm. He was there to have a private lunch with Bill Daley. Daley was the seventh and youngest child of the storied Chicago mayor Richard J. Daley. His brother, Richie, currently occupied City Hall. A banker now, Bill Daley had served as the Secretary of Commerce in Bill Clinton's second term. Daley knew the Clintons well, how ruthless they were, how crazy their world was, and how vulnerable Hillary might be to the right kind of nomination challenge. All of which was why Obama was meeting Daley that day. The midterms were past, and it was time to get serious about the options, and Obama wasn't wasting a moment. "Yeah, you gotta run," Daley told him right off the bat. "Why not? What have you got to lose? Can you win? I think you can. You know, who knows? You don't know, but why wouldn't you? What's the negative here? What are you gonna wait for?" Obama brought up the issue of money. Could he raise enough to be competitive? "I don't think money's your problem," Daley said. Judging by his performance the past 2 years, Obama was a money magnet, and one who might be able to change the game by tapping into small donors to an unprecedented degree. Daley, in fact, suggested that Obama could afford not to rush into the race. Maybe he should take a little more time, prepare himself better for what a challenge to Hillary would entail. "You don't understand," Daley said. "Running around doing fundraisers for other people is not running for president. These people, the Clintons, for 35 years, this is what they do. You've done this now for a couple of years. This is their life. This is like 24/7 for them. Hillary knows where she's going for lunch next March, okay? It's a very different thing here. What Daly was thinking was, be ready, because the shit's gonna come at you big time. Daly was struck by how much consideration Obama already seemed to have devoted to his hypothetical candidacy. To the suggestion that he hang back, Obama responded that he didn't have the luxury of time. If he dawdled, Hillary would lock up too many big donors and key operatives. Obama was clear about something else, which also struck Daly, for its chutzpah. If I can win Iowa, Obama said, I can put this thing away. Yet, for all of his bravado, Obama was still ambivalent about getting into the race, for reasons personal and political. The personal ambivalence was complex and nebulous, but could be resolved down the road. The political ambivalence was more pressing and revolved around one question. Could he and his advisors chart a plausible pathway to victory? The cartographic endeavor began in earnest a few hours after his lunch with Bill Daly ended. The setting was the same, the fourth-floor conference room in Axelrod's office. On the table were cookies, bottled water, and soda. Around it were the members of Obama's personal and professional brain trust, Michelle, Jarrett, and his close friend Marty Nesbitt, Axelrod, Gibbs, Rouse, Mastromonaco, Hildebrand, and Axelrod's business partner David Plouffe. Over the next few hours, Obama received from the group what amounted to a crash course, Presidential Politics 101, the logistics, the mechanics, the calendar, how the whole thing worked. His knowledge about the topic was limited, alarmingly so, thought some at the table. His initial questions rudimentary. How much of his time would be required? How often would he be on the road? Michelle asked if he could come home every weekend, or at least every Sunday, to be with his family. Yes, you can have Sundays off, Hildebrand blurted out. Bullshit, thought Mastromonaco. Crazy, thought Gibbs. Almost to a person, the Obama brain trust was determined that their boss understand how hard running for the White House would be, that none of the bitter realities of the process be sugarcoated. Axelrod and Rouse had long wondered if Obama had the requisite inferno raging in his belly. They wanted him to enter the race eyes wide open, both for his own sake and so there would be no recriminations later. Hildebrand didn't care one whit about raising Obama's consciousness. He wanted him, needed him to run. He was so enamored of Obama that he was willing to say just about anything to get him in, no matter how nonsensical. Sunday's off? Sure. We'll do things differently. We'll use the web. We'll make it work, he assured Obama. No, we won't, Plouffe cut in. And no, you can't come home on Sundays. Rail thin, pretense-free, incapable of artifice, Plouffe had run winning campaigns at the senatorial, congressional, and gubernatorial levels, as well as worked on two prior presidentials. He knew the score. You have two choices, he told Obama. You can stay in the Senate, enjoy your weekends at home, take regular vacations, and have a lovely time with your family. Or you can run for president, have your whole life poked at and pried into, almost never see your family, travel incessantly, bang your tin cup for donations like some street corner beggar, lead a lonely, miserable life. That's your choice, Plouffe explained. There's no middle ground, no shortcuts, especially when you're running against Hillary Clinton. The estimability of the putative Clinton endeavor hovered over the discussion, weighing on Obama. But the people around the table were no rookies at this game. If you had to start from scratch, they were among the best in the business to start there with. Their attitude toward the Clinton machine was clinical and uncowed. The machine was real, but it could be broken down into two constituent parts, personnel and money. Axelrod assured Obama that there were plenty of top-flight players in the party who wouldn't be working for Hillary, especially in the four states that would kick off the nomination contest, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. Iowa loomed large in Axelrod's mind. 20 years earlier, when he worked for Paul Simon's underdog campaign, the Illinois senator lost the caucuses to another candidate from a neighboring state, Missouri Congressman Dick Gephardt, by just 1 percentage point. The lesson for Axelrod was that proximity mattered, that having Chicago as his home base would allow Obama to penetrate Iowa more readily and thoroughly than his would-be rivals, including Clinton. Focusing on Iowa and the other early contests also addressed the second of Hillary's advantages. Though she would likely raise a ton of dough, nobody doubted that Obama could come up with enough to match her in the first four modest-sized states. Obama himself had been fixated on Iowa since the steak fry. He had a good feeling about the place, but that wasn't enough. If the Hawkeye State was going to be so crucial to his chances, he wanted details. Much of November would be spent gathering them, with Hildebrand quietly dispatched to Iowa to do reconnaissance. One night later that month, Hildebrand's phone rang in Sioux Falls, waking him from a sound sleep. Obama was on the line. For the next 45 minutes, he quizzed Hildebrand about every conceivable Iowa-related topic. How would he fare against Edwards in rural counties? The impact of media coverage spilling over from Illinois into the Iowa communities along the Mississippi River, which local officials they could expect to bring on board as endorsers. Hildebrand told him that he, Michelle, and the girls would all have to spend a lot of time in Iowa, and also that the catalyst for winning there would be bringing new voters into the process. If we run a traditional campaign, Hildebrand said, we're doomed. Axelrod had a complimentary view, which he laid out for Obama. In every election, Axelrod argued, the incumbent defines the race, even if he isn't on the ballot, which meant 2008 was going to be defined by Bush. And given the enmity that the president had inspired in the Democratic Party, Axelrod went on, the overwhelmingly liberal primary and caucus electorate would be hungry for a candidate representing the sharpest possible departure from 43, one who promised to be a unifier and not a polarizer, someone non-dogmatic and uncontaminated by the special interest cesspool that Washington had become, and, critically, someone seen as a staunch and principled opponent of the war raging in Iraq. Now, who had a better chance of being that someone, Hillary or Barack? The question answered itself. Axelrod's contention was bolstered by a conversation that Obama had with Rahm Emanuel. Emanuel, an Illinois congressman and another of Axelrod's clients, was one of the shrewdest and most aggressive polls of his generation. He was also a veteran of the Clinton White House, intimately aware of how the couple operated. They're going to do what they got to do to win, and this is not patty cake, Emanuel told Obama. But could they be had? They could be had. There's a soft underbelly with them. The contours of Hillary's vulnerabilities were revealed in detail by polling and focus group testing in Iowa that the Obama Brain Trust secretly commissioned a few weeks later, near the end of 2006. Though the polling put Obama in third place behind Edwards and Clinton, he was within striking distance of both. Not bad, considering that Edwards had been practically living in Iowa for 2 years already, and that Clinton was, well, Clinton. More striking were the focus groups, which were conducted in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids. Almost uniformly, the people in the groups reacted favorably to Obama, to his 2002 speech opposing the war, his rhetoric of change and unity, his freshness and sense of promise. Rarely did they express grave misgivings about his race or his exotic background. The more they knew about his biography and bearing, the more they liked him. In one of the sessions, after watching a video clip of Obama, a white woman said, "There's something about that guy. That's the guy I want. I can't even put it into words." Observing from behind a two-way mirror, Axelrod was floored. "We can't forget that woman," he said to his colleagues. "We have something special here. I feel like I've been handed a porcelain baby. Something very, very precious, but very fragile." The results of the focus groups were equally encouraging when it came to Clinton. She was well-known, well-liked, and well-respected, but inspired nagging doubts. She registered with participants as status quo, as the past and not the future. She stirred up memories of the partisan bickering of the 90s, the Clinton-Gingrich contretemps, Monica, and impeachment.